true love with Wallace's second husband, the couple living up to the description of soulmates. After her death, Wallace wrote to Ernest telling him, "God is difficult to understand at times, for you deserved a well-earned happiness. I know the depth of your sufferings. Your son will be a stronghold for the future." Unlike Wallace, Mary truly loved England, electing to be buried in Somerset in the West Country. As one link to her past was broken, another was gratefully renewed. Wallace's extended visit gave her the chance to see her oldest male friend, Herman Rogers, after a parting of nearly 2 years. She quietly slipped into the Carlton House in Washington for a reunion. The couple was later joined by the Duke, who had to attend an official function. During their get-together, Wallace insisted, nay, pleaded, that he and Catherine join them in Nassau at any time of their choosing. The castaways were desperate for company. Just 4 weeks after they returned to Nassau, Wallace's holiday plans for the Rogerses were truncated following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941. Herman was put in charge of the French section of the new Voice of America radio station, which transmitted shortwave broadcasts into enemy territory. The entrance of America into the war at least gave Wallace a purpose and a focus. As chair of the local Red Cross, she organized food, blankets, and medical assistance for the survivors of ships sunk by German U-boats which were operating in the vicinity. At the same time, the Allies decided to use the islands as a training base for RAF and American Air Force officers and men. While the Duke, as governor, watched over the building of a new runway, the Duchess helped to feed the thousands of young men swarming around the new base. Wallace was a familiar face at the canteen, serving up breakfast for the hungry squaddies. By war's end, she estimated that she had doled out 40,000 plates of bacon and egg. Even her sternest critics acknowledged her selfless endeavors. Her friend Rosa Wood wrote to Edith Lindsay in New York, saying, "I really admire the way Wallace has thrown herself into all her various jobs. She really is wonderful and does work hard. I do hope people everywhere are realizing all the good she is doing. I think she has such charm and is always amusing to be with. I really don't know what I would do without her." Brisk, businesslike, and decisive, Wallace was the power behind the throne, the Duke asking her advice on everything, big and small. It became a standing joke in the ruling executive council that he would never make a decision of any consequence without reference to her. During discussions at Government House, he would often excuse himself and race upstairs, an agenda in hand, looking for his wife. "I have rarely seen an ascendancy established over one partner in a marriage by the other to so remarkable a degree," remarked British Embassy press attaché René McCall. "He deferred to her constantly and consistently, always remarking, 'I'll see what the Duchess has to say about that.'" Those in his circle knew exactly how to play him. On one occasion, when his aide, Captain Wood, asked the Duke to wear a dress uniform for a parade, he petulantly refused, saying that it was too hot. Wood replied that it was a significant occasion and emphasized that it was important to obey the social niceties. He made the same case to Wallace, who told him, "Leave it with me." A few minutes later, the Duke appeared in full dress uniform and said, somewhat sheepishly, "I've changed my mind." In spite of his dithering, the Duke's term was assessed as a success, especially given the inherent difficulty of working with an insular, bigoted cabal of local businessmen known as the Bay Street Boys, who effectively controlled the island's economy. Though he liked to give the impression of being a fervent believer in democracy, it was an attitude, recalled Wood, that held good only if everyone agreed with him. He was no reformer, continuing the traditions of segregation as practiced by the indigenous ruling white population. When a black resident entered Government House, he came in through the back door. Wallace's military canteen was also segregated. Indeed, at one charity event, after she found herself shaking hands with a multitude of well-wishers, including Arthur, their black chauffeur. Wallace, who had black servants during her childhood, remarked to local historian Mary Mosley, "It's the first time in my life I have ever shaken the hand of a colored person." In spite of her charity efforts, Wallace found that time hung heavily, life in Nassau an endless horizon of tedium. "It really is so intensely dull here," she wrote. "I long for news of the big world, no matter how trivial." Her letters to friends were peppered with complaints about seeing the same old faces on an endless loop. "There is very little news here, same people, behaving the same way, and the RAF not producing any Don Juans." So when U.S. Republican Congressman Joe Martin and a fellow politician arrived in Nassau for a vacation, Wallace wasted no time in inviting them to lunch at Government House. Martin, a lifelong bachelor, was cornered by Wallace and got the full flirty treatment. As he was leaving, she said coquettishly, "Mr. Martin, I think I should like you for my next husband." Martin blanched and hurried away. This was a jolly luncheon in a sea of monotony. One worrying development was her husband's pronounced drinking, insisting on "no Buckingham Palace measures here," as he shakily poured his evening livener. Amidst the litany of complaint, what is striking about her private correspondence is her enthusiasm to see Herman and Catherine Rogers. She sent a confetti of letters to their apartment in New York and then, in desperation, took to writing to mutual friends, asking them to encourage the Rogerses to make the journey south. In a note to one friend, Edith Lindsay, she admitted she was heartbroken that they were not coming and complained that she hadn't heard a word from them. It seems Herman was busy with his war work for Voice of America. Wallace explained their absence by citing the Nassau disease, everyone looking for excuses to avoid the islands. "If I was in the same boat, I would do the same," she confessed. On October 17, 1942, she wrote plaintively, "How I long for the sight and sound of human beings. My mentality is getting dim after over 2 years here, and only 2 months' leave." How bright would she have shone if the only man she had ever loved had visited? Certainly she made clear who she really wanted to see, confiding in Rosa Wood that she considered Catherine to be a dull, stupid, boring woman. Or, in other words, she had snagged Herman before Wallace had a chance. From time to time, the outside world intruded, invariably in the form of bad news. On August 25, 1942, the Duke was informed of the death of his younger brother, the Duke of Kent, in a flying accident. They had once been boon companions and the closest of friends, but the abdication changed that forever. The Duke's reaction said much about the distance that now existed between himself and the rest of his family. In the days before the memorial service, to be held in Nassau's Christ Church Cathedral, he fretted that the Nazis, knowing that the Duke and Duchess were to be present, would find a way to bomb the church. As a result, information about the church service was summarily withdrawn, lest it get into enemy hands. While the Duchess dutifully replied to the messages of sympathy, writing of the terrible shock and the irreparable loss of Prince George, neither ever wrote a note to the grieving widow, Princess Marina, knowing that she and Queen Elizabeth were the most vocal members of the royal family in opposing Wallace and any possible title. It worked both ways. An olive branch sent by Wallace to Queen Mary, suggesting that she might wish to meet the retiring Bishop of Nassau, who was sailing to England and could fully describe her son's positive contribution to the islands, remained unanswered. When the bishop did indeed meet with Queen Mary, he spoke warmly of the Duchess. The Queen's response was icy indifference. Wallace remained a non-person. Eventually, it all became too much. The heat, humidity, workload, and the strain of entertaining her husband took a medical toll, and the Duchess was taken ill with stomach ulcers. it was a condition that affected her for the rest of her life. She was paying the price of keeping everything tightly wrapped. A nasty fall downstairs in 1943, which left her badly bruised, immobile, and depressed, merely added to her medical woes. Though the Duke was anxious that she go to the mainland to recover, she declined, shuddering at the thought of being criticized for once again leaving her post. The couple was highly sensitive to the merest hint of criticism. For instance, the Duke threatening journalist Helen Warden with a criminal libel suit following an astringent portrait in the American Mercury magazine. By the end of 1944, the heat and her hard work had shaved her down from a slender 110 pounds to a gaunt 100 pounds. While she liked to remark that a woman can never be too rich or too thin, there were limits. Her drastic weight loss coincided with another visit to New York, this time to have her appendix removed. These bouts of ill health, as well as visits to see another invalid, Aunt Bessie, who had broken her hip in a fall, meant long periods of recuperation and relaxation away from the dreaded islands. In total, the couple was absent for 4 months in 1943 and a further 18 weeks the following year. By then, they were desperate to escape for good and were deeply envious of others who did not have to secure the agreement of the Colonial Office before moving on. When their friends and aides George Wood and his Austrian wife Rosa informed them in December 1944 that they were sailing for Lisbon, the Windsors reacted with fury. They saw the decision as a personal betrayal, a slight to the Duke and a snub to the Duchess. The Woods became yet another entry in the lengthening roster of loyal supporters who were once cherished and then discarded by the ducal couple. An anguished Rosa Wood expressed her shock in a letter to their mutual friend, Edith Lindsay. "We were in Nassau for a fortnight to pack up and say goodbye. Our goodbye, unfortunately, was a very unpleasant one. The moment the Windsors knew we were leaving, they both suddenly became very nasty, made out that we were letting them down, and only used them while it suited us. Almost funny when George worked for the Duke for 4 years without one penny pay. And I certainly did all to help Wallace. A very unpleasant ending, and undeserved. It has somehow left us with a bitter, disillusioned feeling." Yet no sooner had Captain and Rosa Wood departed than the Windsors followed suit. They spent Christmas with a fully recovered Aunt Bessie and, after some discussion, decided to curtail the Duke's tour of duty. The couple left for New York in March rather than August 1945, the official date his tour of duty was over. While they were showered with engraved silver trays, boxes, and parchments of appreciation from the grateful Bahamians, there was no official recognition of their service from the Colonial or Foreign Office, no letter of thanks, let alone a campaign medal. As for Buckingham Palace, the silence was deafening. Though the war in Europe was nearing its conclusion, a new royal Cold War was about to begin. Chapter 15. The Only Man I've Ever Loved. Flight Lieutenant Archibald Wan was a pioneer, brave, cool-headed, and lucky. He needed to be. In the experimental world of dirigibles and military balloons, Juan was something of a human guinea pig, testing these newfangled flying machines to the limit and beyond. He began his military career in the Royal Navy, in the same term at the Royal Naval College Osborne as Prince Bertie, but transferred to naval airships in 1915. Their paths crossed again, however, Prince Albert becoming the first member of the royal family to learn how to fly, followed shortly afterwards by his elder brother. On August 23, 1921, when Juan was commanding the airship R-38 on a test flight over Hull in the north of England, his luck ran out. Flying at 62 miles an hour at a height of 2,500 feet, the bulky airship, as long as the Lusitania, broke in two and burst into flames. thousands of onlookers watching in horror as the burning structure plunged into the Humber estuary. Of the 49 crew, only 5 men survived. One, who was plucked from the gray waters, was burned so badly that he was never expected to fly again. He proved the doubters wrong, qualifying as a Spitfire and flying boat pilot, commended time and time again by senior officers for his total dedication, talent, and leadership. With his film star looks, he had a touch of the Gary Coopers and the Alan Ladds about him, colorful background, and status as a senior RAF officer, Archie was quite the catch. When he was commanding officer of the RAF base at Boscombe Down in Wiltshire, he met Marie Lucy Fury, the couple marrying in London on January 6, 1938. The daughter of Alsatian farmers, Lucy, then 32, had been married twice before, first to a farmer named Richefeur, with whom she had a son, Danny, then to a Parisian artist and businessman who killed himself. Socially ambitious, forceful, and very attractive, she had the hint of naughtiness in her coquettish glance that men found irresistible. She was, though, much more than a pretty face. She was a strong character with the ability to hold her own in a group and in a catfight. She fitted in well as a hostess at military functions. Archie was duly smitten. On their third anniversary in January 1941, when he was in command of the RAF in Northern Ireland, he sent her a tender love note reflecting on their future together. "My darling, this is just to say that the past 3 years have been the happiest of my life, and that I feel quite sure that they are but the prelude of the many happy years in front of us. Together there is nothing we cannot do, but apart we are lost. Je t'aime." A year after the war's end, during which time he was promoted to Air Commodore in Malta, in charge of 212 Fighter Group, Archie retired, the couple moving to the sunny climes of the south of France. He was 50, Lucy was just 40. A social mountaineer par excellence, Lucy was thrilled when Archie renewed his acquaintance with the Duke of Windsor, whom, it seems, he met through flying. The prince, touring various airfields during and after the war before learning to fly himself. She could have been Wallace's prettier younger sister, for both women were cut from the same cloth, tough, conniving, strong-willed, and socially ambitious, with tart tongues and tempers touched by the Furies. Like Wallace, she skillfully presented a front to the world, hiding or disguising that which was socially unpalatable. For example, she always gave the impression that Danny was Archie's son by birth rather than adoption. Though Lucy recognized herself in Wallace, she was smart enough to disguise her motives, always deferring to the older and more famous woman. Their raw rivalry would come to the surface later. After all, Wallace was royalty of sorts, and Lucy was enthralled by those of noble birth and breeding. Excited but daunted at the same time, Lucy was in seventh heaven when she and Archie were invited for dinner at La Croix, where the Windsors were once again established in regal splendor, cotton sheets, silverware, and all. The German mines in the garden, the concrete pillboxes, and the radar aerial on the roof had all been cleared away. Installed in their place were 26 staff, including a switchboard operator, concierge, and 3 gardeners. This miniature kingdom ruled by Wallace with a gimlet eye for dust and dirty linen. It was at Wallace's groaning table that the Wands first met Herman and Catherine Rogers, the old quartet becoming a sextet as Lucy inveigled her way into the charmed circle. They played golf, backgammon, and bridge together, went shopping, and of course dined regularly, either at home or in one of the many famous local restaurants. While Lucy did not have the grooming of Wallace, she not only had youth and beauty on her side, The Duke was delighted to have a regular dinner table guest who spoke German, his favorite language. The proximity of the Wands, the Windsors, and the Rogerses confounded the Riviera gossips. After the war, the talk was that the Rogerses were no longer welcome at the top table, their places taken by Lucy and Archie. Not so, asserted Eleanor Miles, a longtime friend and correspondent of Wallace's who came to stay with the ducal couple for 10 days in August 1947. The Herman Rogers came over from Cannes to swim and lunch. I told Wallace that so many people had said they were all on the outs. This is, however, not true. As you will see, we saw a great deal of them. Then, with a hint at Wallace's fascination with Herman, she added, "He is extremely attractive, I found." The Duchess presided over a peripatetic court, traveling to Paris, then sailing to New York before heading to Palm Beach and thence back to the south of France. Consistently denied an official position by an assortment of ministers and governments, the Windsors were leaders of society in other ways, the Pied Pipers of the international demi-monde, slaves to a modern-day version of the Golden Triangle, the notorious trade in human flesh. As society hostess Elsa Maxwell observed, "Wherever the Duke and Duchess go, the world goes, the world of the beautiful people." Their life revolved around entertaining, the Duchess a perfectionist impresario of the nightly theater, their salon a small court in exile where guests were expected to observe the same formalities as if the Duke were still king and Wallace his consort. As fashion guru Eleanor Lambert noted, "They were both formal and informal. This meant curtsying to them both on arrival and leaving, and allowing them to start any conversation or amusement. In short, you always deferred to their leadership." Yet clouds invariably hovered over this scene of sunny perfection. It was a rare evening where the Duchess failed to take a dig at the royal family, particularly Cookie, Queen Elizabeth. The Windsors felt their position as royal outsiders keenly. It soured their public behavior and stained their marriage. The Duke was kept abreast of upcoming family events by his mother, Queen Mary, such as with the wedding of Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip in November 1947. However, they remained studiously uninvited. Around the time of the royal wedding, with the king's health precarious, the Duke was drawn into a half-baked plot to replace George VI as regent. It proved a non-starter, one of the many harebrained schemes initiated by controversial political insider Kenneth de Courcy, who fed off the red meat of rancor at the Duke's table. De Courcy, who later adopted the grandiose title the Duc de Grandmesnil, recalled, "I never stayed or dined without hearing a bitter sarcasm directed at the royal family. George VI, a stupid man, could never have successfully competed with the Duchess of Windsor's tongue, and the Duke could not control it." As a result, the official court would never give an inch to the royal outcasts. "The court's attitude was directed by the Queen. She felt that however loyal the Duke might be to his brother, Wallace would egg him on into activities which were harmful to the king, while her witty, sarcastic attitude to the royal family would become the talk of London as it had of Paris." The Duke's party piece was to mock his acquisitive mother, Queen Mary, an after-dinner skit that amused but also shocked. The Queen had the reputation of acquiring objets from the homes of those she visited. She would admire the object in question, and then the hostess would say, "We would love to give it to Your Majesty. We will send it." In the voice of Queen Mary, the Duke replied, "Oh no, I will take it right along with me in my car." The Windsor's American houseguest, Harvey Ledieu, who watched the Duke's performance at Somerset Maugham's home, remarked, "His audience laughed, but I thought it was in very bad taste to do such an imitation of his wonderful mother." During this post-war period, Wallace's one-time lover Felipe Espiel and his wife Courtney, who had so feared Wallace's influence, quite fortuitously enjoyed privileged ringside seats at these rival royal courts. In 1946, Felipe was briefly transferred from Washington to become the ambassador to the court of St. James's in London, before being summarily summoned home by the new junta in Buenos Aires. During that time, the couple had the chance to cast a critical eye over the four protagonists and to explore their own past connections with the ducal couple. They first broke the ice when the Windsors invited them to their Paris home on Boulevard Suchet. Courtney noted in her diary, "The table was a dream and the food and wines perfect. The Duke was very cordial and gay, speaking amazingly good Spanish to Felipe. Wallace was smart as always in a low-necked green satin gown, but is too thin and ate practically nothing at dinner." Then Felipe traveled to Buckingham Palace for an audience with the king. He found him similar in temperament to his brother, but slower.
"Just a nice boy, with not much intelligence."
As for the queen, they were both enchanted by George VI's consort. Courtney described her as graciousness itself. "Her smile is radiant, it lights up her bright gray eyes. She gives one the feeling of warmth and womanly friendliness. Certainly not pretty or handsome and rather too roundish of face, she nevertheless has a deeper quality which captivates one and holds you quite spellbound. While with her, I thought of her who could have been Queen of England, and who also has a quality of holding one spellbound. How utterly different these two women are! It would be difficult to find a greater contrast." Yet for all her previous animosity and contempt, Courtney found herself forging an unlikely friendship with Wallace Windsor. The Windsors accepted an invitation by the departing Argentinian ambassador to be guests of honor at the Espiels' last official dinner at the embassy in London in October 1946. It was a move that sealed their friendship, Courtney noting, "At any rate, the old ghost of the old affairs is now laid away forever. The four of us, including the Duke, who was considerably bothered undoubtedly by the silly and persistent references to Espiel, have become friends. Perhaps one might even say friends in adversity." Just as the Espiels had been treated badly by their government, so the Windsors were leaving for New York empty-handed, without an official job and without most of the Duchess's jewels, which had been stolen during their visit. Not that anyone would have known. That night, Wallace was slim and straight as a pencil, beautifully gowned in the last word from Balenciaga in Paris. She showed no sign of the shock of most of her jewels being stolen from the home of Lord Dudley near Windsor Great Park, where the couple was staying. A popular theory was that the royal family had ordered the heist to reclaim some of the gems they had lost when the Duke abdicated.
"Most unfortunate," Wallace confided. "The whole unhappy incident has cast an unpleasant shadow on our visit to England."
She was more direct with her husband, conflating the jewel heist with the official treatment of the Duke.
"I hate this place," she said, looking out over the misty English countryside. "I shall hate it to my grave."
Later, the Duke's financial advisor, Sir Edward Peacock, told Courtney that the Duke was very depressed and disappointed not to be offered an official job. The king, he claimed, had tried to get him something, but the socialist Labour government had said no to the idea of him becoming governor of any of the dominions, including Canada. Later, the Duke told Eleanor Miles that he had in fact been offered the governor-generalship of Australia, but had turned it down. After arriving in New York, they ruled over a rather smaller kingdom, Suite 28A of the Waldorf Astoria. Within hours, though, Wallace had transformed the anonymous hotel rooms into a tiny piece of ducal territory, tricked out with family portraits and photographs as well as silver and bejeweled trinkets.
One wall was dominated by a three-quarter-length portrait of Wallace painted at the time of the abdication.
"It hasn't got your expression at all," said one guest.
"I don't know," replied Wallace with a half-smile. "It has that puzzled look."
As ever, the tables and the food were impeccable, though the guests left something to be desired.
All the Palm Beach crowd, the cafe society, the rich, the idle.
"We listened to a poor piano player and drank champagne," commented Courtney Espiel after attending one dinner party.
For all the perfectly placed photo frames, considered cushions, and important knick-knacks, there was an emptiness at the heart of the Duchess's restless existence.
"She is the most unhappy of women, always trying to get away from life, rushing on feverishly to keep from thinking," confided her close friend Betty Lawson Johnston. It was a condition sensed by those sensitive souls who found themselves in her company.
While New York socialite Betsy Barton found her witty, bright, and charming, she also thought her garrulous, mistaking mindless chatter for conversation.
"She talks very rapidly, scarcely giving anyone time to say anything, and after trying to act intelligent, I finally found myself nodding at her and exclaiming with little no reallys and you don't says. She spoke of her figure and keeping thin, and said she had been accused of never taking any exercise. But I say, my problems exercise me."
Barton, who was wheelchair-bound, reflected,
"I wondered what problems she might have, and visualized the ordinary shopgirl who thinks of the Duchess as having everything in the world. I would say that she has nothing. She and her husband are exiles. They must wander everywhere but in their home country, which is where they long to be. They receive adulation and awed acclaim from people whom they do not care to get it from. They must meet the people who they do not really care to meet. Looking at the Duke, he is a sorry specimen of a man, small, nervous, rather unformed, and not awfully bright."
In the immediate post-war years, this became a frequent observation of those, particularly the English, who had not seen him since the abdication.
"One is almost unpleasantly shocked to see how old, wrinkled, and worried his face is, and how pathetic his expression," commented Lady Cynthia Gladwin, wife of a senior British diplomat, who saw him on Mount Street in Mayfair during one of his sporadic visits to London in May 1947. When Washington Grand Dame Susan Mary Alsop saw him in Paris, she was scathing.
"He is so pitiful. I never saw a man so bored. The highlight of his day was watching his wife buy a hat."
Increasingly eccentric, too, as Robert D. Levitt, the former husband of musical comedy star Ethel Merman, attested when he was asked why the Duke hummed to himself all the time.
"I'm not sure, but I think he's on AC, and you know the Waldorf is on DC," he quipped.
Back in the south of France, the Duke was similarly out of tune when concert pianist Barbara Reed, Catherine Rogers's niece, played for him at Louvier. As she recalled, "he wandered around and hummed off-key to himself, clearly not interested in listening to classical music. Most distracting, but an experience." This was something of a polite understatement, the Duke a musical philistine to his fingertips. Once, after fidgeting through a private concert organized by Lady Cunard, he asked pleasantly,
"Did that Mozart chap write anything else?"
He was happiest on a sunny day with a three-iron in hand and companionable playing partners to share the afternoon four-ball. A regular at the tee-off was his friend from his days at Osborne, Archie Wan. The retired pilot was sadly missed when he contracted stomach cancer. His was a particularly lingering death. As Lucy Wan was a convert to Christian Science, which practices prayer rather than pills for pain, Archie's last days were played out in excruciating agony. Lucy's mother, who came to nurse her son-in-law, was often so distressed by his screams and whimpering that she had to leave the house.
He died on October 11, 1948. Archie's ill health coincided with growing concern about Catherine Rogers. Just 2 weeks before Archie died, she was in a hospital in Montpellier, undergoing extensive tests as well as an exploratory operation on her throat. Wallace, for all the unkind things she had said and written about one of her oldest friends, took the trouble to be with her, and Herman. During her visit, she wrote to Constance Coolidge, urging her to write Catherine a newsy note. It was a letter of concern, hoping for the best but fearing the worst. "I was with Catherine Friday up until 7. She was wonderful. The operation was done with a local and really was a preparation for some new kind of X-ray treatment just over from America." After describing the treatment, she finished, "I know how you feel about Catherine, and as I said today, I do feel worried about her condition." She was right to be concerned. Catherine's health deteriorated quickly, Herman's wife of nearly 30 years suffering from inoperable throat cancer. On March 24, 1949, 2 months before she died, she wrote to Constance, apologizing for failing to respond to her earlier letters. "You are a lamb to write, and it means a lot to me. I just did not feel like answering. Knew you would understand, as I have no energy at all, and tire so very easily. Only weigh 50 kilos, 110 pounds. She went on to explain that 2 major operations in 6 months had left her listless and feeling like hell most of the time. She reported that she had been seen by 3 specialists who had mistakenly given her a clean bill of health. Catherine died on May 31, 1949, and was buried in June at the Grand Jas Cemetery in Cannes, the final resting place for many in the English and American expat community. In a heartfelt letter to Constance Coolidge, her grieving widower wrote, "Thank God she went when she did, in her sleep. Her heart just stopped. Further terrible suffering lay just ahead of her, I know it, and the knowledge broke my heart. Everything was done for her that could possibly be done. I am sure she could not have had better care or treatment, even in America." Within a few short months, the sextet had become a quartet. Herman, whom Wallace had always considered her property, now a widower, and Lucy a widow. Herman was, though, taken aback by Wallace's response to Catherine's death. At first, she asked him to stay with her and the Duke in Paris, but he declined, feeling that he had too much to do in Louviers. When the Windsors eventually came to their Riviera home, Herman asked Wallace to choose a keepsake of Catherine's to remember her by. He expected her to pick a framed portrait of his late wife or some other personal item. Instead, she asked for the 2 gold bracelets she had heard him say that he had paid 10,000 francs, $8,500, for. As Herman absorbed this latest grotesque and hurtful example of Wallace's acquisitive nature, he was having to come to terms with the sad fact that his own well-ordered life was over. While his marriage to Catherine had long lost its excitement and sexual tension, she had been a faithful and stimulating companion for nearly 30 years, traveling the world by his side. Now he was alone. Wealthy, well-educated, well-connected, he was a catch. A catch that Lucy Wan was determined to snare. "What Lucy wanted, Lucy got," recalls her daughter-in-law, Kitty Blair. "She was a piece of work." Almost before Catherine's body was cold, Lucy was on the scene. She knew she had to act quickly. Instinctively, Lucy realized that she would have competition for Herman's hand from Wallace. Though Lucy did not know then about Wallace's offer to have a child by Herman or their sexually intimate conversations, feminine instinct told her that they had been lovers from years before, and that that flame could quickly be reignited. Moreover, Herman had been Wallace's de facto husband for all the critical moments in her life. It had been Herman, not the Duke, who had given her shelter and comfort when she most needed it. Both now had their eyes on the prize, Herman Livingston Rogers.
"There is no question that these women were rivals in love," recalls Lucy's daughter-in-law, who spent many hours alone with her discussing Herman and Wallace. Both wanted Herman. Wallace would have grabbed him and told the Duke to go. Lucy knew that. Such was her fear of Wallace winning out that within months of Catherine's death she was putting pressure on Herman to marry. It became a nagging theme in their budding relationship, to the point where he wrote reassuring her that he would marry, but wanted more time to grieve his late wife. Even if Wallace did not throw her garter into the romantic ring and decided to stay with the Duke, Lucy was concerned that she would try and convince Herman that this farmer's daughter was well beneath the station of a Groton and Yale man. He could do better, much better. During this critical time, Lucy had one clear advantage. The Duchess was in America. She planned to return to France in mid-May 1950, sailing on the Queen Mary. The clock was ticking. She had to work fast. Herman, gentleman to the last, was as good as his word. He asked Lucy to marry him in June 1950. It was not a moment too soon. When Herman wrote to Wallace, likely the first person he contacted with the news, all Lucy's worst fears were realized. The sound of the Duchess's jaw dropping could be heard all the way from Manhattan to Cannes. It was a profound shock, all the more so coming weeks after the death on May 29th of her first husband, Win Spencer, in a hotel room in Coronado. Herman explained that the wedding was arranged for August 6th, and he expressed the hope that she and the Duke would be their witnesses at the civil ceremony, which was due to take place in Cannes Town Hall. Wallace responded that they were booked for August 6th, but if they could change the date, they would naturally be present. Herman duly obliged, changing their wedding day to August 3rd to accommodate the Windsors. Wallace's telegram ended with the battle cry, "Don't do anything until I get there. Your guardian angel." That phrase hid a multitude of emotions, none of them feelings of affection towards Lucy. Battle was now joined. Wallace had come to look on Herman as a form of reserve capital, which Catherine's death now promised to make available for the first time, a family friend told her biographer Charles Murphy. For the prize to fall so swiftly and easily to a comparative stranger wounded Wallace deeply, and the wound was plain to see. Her boredom in her own marriage had become acute, and she was no longer as discreet as before when it came to hiding her feelings. During the run-up to the big day, Wallace did her best to unsettle Herman, reminding him that when he married Catherine, the daughter of a doctor from Colorado Springs, his own family was cool about the match, believing he was marrying beneath himself. What, she cooed, would they think of him marrying a farmer's daughter and a German to boot? For a time, Lucy bit her tongue. Since Lucy Wan had come into the royal circle, she had been careful not to antagonize the Duchess, seeing in her a reflection of herself, one social climber recognizing another. As the August 3rd wedding day approached, neither woman took the trouble to hide their mutual animosity, at least in private. "They despised one another," recalled Kitty Blair. "They were cut from the same cloth. Socially ambitious vipers who would do anything, walk over anyone, to get what they wanted." Not that Wallace publicly gave any hint of her true feelings. On August 1st, 1950, shortly before the wedding, she penned an affectionate and friendly letter to her love rival.
"Dear Lucy, just a little thought for you on your wedding day. May it bring with it all my wishes for happiness with my dear friend Herman. May you both have many long years together. I hope very much that you and I will become friends, as the Rogers house has always been like my second house, and I would miss that feeling very much.
The Duke and myself are so glad that we are able to be with you on this very important day. With all good wishes to my dear Lucy, I am yours very sincerely, Wallace Windsor. However, Wallace revealed the true state of her heart in the wedding gifts she chose for the couple. She gave Lucy a little straw bag, which, the bride-to-be contemptuously remarked, was the kind of present they would give a maid. In addition, they gave them an antique silver salver, bearing their monogram and an inscription that made Lucy's blood boil. Not only was the date wrong, they married on August 3, 1950. To add insult to injury, the dedication was to Herman alone. It read, "To Herman Livingston Rogers, on the occasion of his marriage, August 9, 1950, from Edward and Wallace." Lucy Fury Wan was well named. On the day she opened their gift, she threw an absolute tantrum. "She had a temper on her, and it came out then," recalls her daughter-in-law. As her wedding day dawned, Lucy vowed to herself that she was not going to allow that woman to spoil her moment in the sun. It was a close-run thing, the temperature rising the moment Wallace arrived at Louvier. She had chosen to wear a beautiful white dress, a clear breach of wedding etiquette. It was an obvious attempt to upstage the bride, as if it was Wallace who was marrying Herman, not Lucy. To compound matters, just before the bridal party set off for the mairie in Cannes, Wallace started adjusting Lucy's wedding dress, saying that it didn't fit properly. She tugged at the satin collar, pulling it this way and that until it was quite out of shape. "There," she said, "that's better." Lucy simmered but bit her tongue. In the wedding pictures, it seems that any damage done by the Duchess had been rectified. After the short ceremony, which was also witnessed by Lucy's son Danny, the party went for a wedding breakfast at La Bonne Auberge in Antibes. Then the party separated to rest before the main reception, which was due to be held at Louvier between 6 and 8 o'clock. By 8 o'clock, the guests of honor, the Duke and Duchess, had not arrived, and many guests started to drift away, clutching their pieces of wedding cake, provided by the absent Windsors. By the time they arrived at 8:45, all but two guests had gone. Wallace apologized, saying that they had an urgent appointment with their architect, which could not be delayed. "But Wallace, he was at our reception," said Lucy sweetly. Their behavior was, in Herman's words, purposeful selfishness. Lucy, though, had the final word. When they were alone together, Wallace seized Lucy by the hands and told her, "I'll hold you responsible if anything ever happens to Herman. He's the only man I've ever loved." Lucy let those 7 words linger long enough for the enormity of what Wallace had said to sink in. Then she replied, "How nice for the Duke," looking hard into Wallace's eyes. Wallace blushed and said quickly, "There was never anything between Herman and me." Lucy replied triumphantly, "Of course not, Wallace." Then she spat, "You got your king, but I got your Herman." And she turned away in triumph. It was like she had conquered the world, recalled Kitty Blair. That night, the foursome were joined by a number of friends, including the oil tycoon and art benefactors, Charles and Jane Reitzman, for dinner at a restaurant in Cannes. Wallace spent the whole evening trying to eat Herman up and ignoring her dining partner, Charles Reitzman. A Spanish guest, who was seated next to Lucy, asked her quizzically, "Aren't you jealous?" Lucy replied, "My husband doesn't notice it." At one point during the evening, Wallace recalled the years they had spent together, remembering, "Dear China." "Let's talk Chinese," she said brightly, as a transparent attempt to show her continued ownership of Herman, while excluding Lucy from the conversation. Herman, knowing full well that she spoke only 3 words of Chinese, was not going to be a party to her games. So he said that he had forgotten all his Chinese, even though he was still fluent. As they drove home, Herman told his bride, "She will never be satisfied. Never." For their honeymoon, Herman had hired a yacht. His own yacht, the Angelique, had been commandeered by the Italian Navy during the war, and had already asked the Windsors to join them. On the first night, they docked in Monte Carlo and joined friends at the Hôtel de Paris restaurant. During dinner, Lucy showed Wallace the enormous gold and diamond wedding ring Herman had given her. Lucy thought Herman had been way too extravagant and pondered sending it back. Wallace whisked her to the ladies' room where she told her, "Don't be a fool. When a man gives you something, take it. It means money." Lucy was struck not only by her predatory instincts, but by how she never referred to a husband, but always a man, as if she were talking about a bank. Her walking, talking bank arrived the next day when the Rogers' yacht docked alongside a boat hired by Woolworth heir Jimmy Donahue. Wallace insisted the party join him for lunch on board. Herman, never having met the man but aware of his reputation as an outrageous homosexual, demurred. "You two go if you wish. Lucy and I will stay here." From that moment, Wallace pulled down the flag on the not-so-jolly Rogers, for the next 4 years going overboard for the much younger man. It marked a sea change in her life, Wallace now spending all her time with Jimmy Donahue rather than her Riviera friends. She was enchanted by his lavish attention and his generosity. Though she wanted for nothing, the scars of her childhood deprivation cut deep. As with the expensive memento she chose to remember Catherine Rogers, Wallace was seduced by the costly and lavish. Over the years, Donahue showered her with jewels, including a magnificent sapphire ring, furs, flowers, chartered yachts, billets doux, but above all else, uncomplicated devotion. It was a very public relationship that shocked and surprised even the most sophisticated. Many thought Wallace had gone quite mad. Others could see that Jimmy was the rebound guy now that Herman Rogers was once again tantalizingly out of reach. The observant Lady Gladwin reflected on Wallace at this time. She became rude, odious, and strange. One had the impression she was either drugged or drunk. She spent all her time with effeminate young men staying in nightclubs until dawn and sending the Duke home early. Buzz off, mosquito! What a way to address the once King of England! The beginning of her dalliance with Donahue marked not only a new coolness between Wallace and Herman, but also a step change in her treatment of her poor, whimpering husband. She had always been sarcastic and sharp-tongued. "I wasn't castle-born like you," was a frequent retort. Now she became increasingly cruel and careless of his feelings. "Will I be going to bed in tears tonight?" was his pathetic refrain when she was particularly unpleasant. Yet he seems to have taken a lifelong delight in this degradation. As veteran courtier Ulick Alexander observed, the former king was possessed by the sexual perversion of self-abasement. The duke always came back for more. The affair Donahue began harmlessly enough. Wallace, a longtime friend of Jimmy's mother Jessie, one of 3 wealthy daughters of Frank W. Woolworth, the founder of the Woolworth stores. Bankrolled by his indulgent mother, Jimmy came along for the ride, a jester in search of a court, as biographer Joe Bryan put it. Jessie Woolworth Donahue, who first met the Windsors in April 1941 at Palm Beach, was the principal guest when the Duke threw a birthday party for his wife at La Croix after the war. And why not? After all, it was Jessie who funded much of their extravagant lifestyle, her investment in the Windsors giving her social status and cachet. It was an unspoken exchange, and naturally Jimmy was part of the Donahue ticket. That night Wallace was in a gay, affectionate, and self-deprecating mood. At the appropriate moment, the Duke signaled the butler to bring in the magnificent five-tier birthday cake. As the cake, adorned with a solitary candle, made its stately entrance, the Duchess quipped, "Darling, you've been messing in my kitchen." Then she stood poised with a knife ready to cut into the elaborate creation.
"I don't know where to begin. I guess I will just have to start at the bottom and work my way up."
Everyone hooted, and Jessie stood ready to give a toast to her royal friend. Before she could begin, Wallace butted in and said,
"Once my ambition was to be Queen of England. Now it's to get Jessie Donahue drunk."
While Jessie soberly bankrolled the Windsors, it was her son who gradually insinuated himself into the Windsors' lives. Jimmy was an ever-present, joining them at dinner, late-night cabarets, and parties. Much to the delight of the Duke, who was blessed with a thick streak of parsimony, he always picked up the check. The inclusion of a gay man in their inner circle was nothing unusual, even though the Duke had a well-known disdain for homosexuality. On one occasion, when they were having an argument about their gay friends, Wallace spat,
"You should listen to them. They are much brighter than you."
The reality was that his attitude towards the gay community was, at the very least, ambivalent. The Duke had been raised at Buckingham Palace, where the entire edifice was dependent on the unstinting service of confirmed bachelors. His favorite brother, Prince George, was said to be bisexual. During their secret romance in 1936, King Edward met Wallace at the Belgravia apartment of Vogue's John McMullen, himself a lifelong bachelor. He was their go-between, and together with Elsie Mendel, he decorated the Windsors' home and became a dinner-table regular, one of those known by society hostesses as the little brothers of the rich. During the mid-1940s, his place was taken by the wealthy American equestrian Harvey LeDoux, who regularly hosted raucous stag parties at his Maryland hunting estate, Pleasant Valley Farm. He became a frequent companion to both the Duke and Duchess, on one occasion accompanying the Duke when he reviewed a Royal Navy ship docked at Cannes. Primarily, though, LeDoux was the Duchess's walker, squiring events the Duke would not or could not attend. When LeDoux was staying at the Ritz in Paris, he was thrilled when the Duchess accepted his invitation to lunch.
As she liked to say, "I married David for better or worse, but not for lunch."
That honor went to LeDoux.
"We lunched alone at Maxime's," he wrote. "Can you imagine how everyone stared?" Wallace had never gone out to lunch without the Duke before. Wouldn't Charlie Knickerbocker, the gossip columnist, like this bit of information?
Shortly afterwards, on November 13, 1946, he told his sister,
"Wallace W. has asked me to take her to Noel Coward's opening of Present Laughter. The Duke disapproves of Noel's morals and won't go."
This was an odd decision, as Noel Coward, along with Somerset Maugham, dined regularly with the Windsors, to the point where Coward complained he saw too much of them. Enter into this milieu Jimmy Donahue. Unlike other gay men in the Windsor circle, discretion was not his strong point. He loved to shock. A regular party trick was to strip naked during dinner. When sober, he was witty, charismatic, and charming, always ready with a well-honed anecdote, a pithy remark, or a song on his lips when he played the piano. In drink, it was a different story. Donahue, reckless and aggressive, a wealthy young man who had had a number of costly brushes with the law, one involving a naked salesman, a razor blade, and a partly severed ear. Weekends were too complicated, too drunken, and much too dangerous. Donahue hosting wild parties at his Long Island home. Usually, several carry cars brought his guests, boys and young men, who would drink until insensible, Then they would be taken to his basement rooms, which were decorated in all black or all red, to await the master of the house.
"All I want to be able to see is their teeth and their eyeballs," he instructed his interior designer friend, Billy Baldwin.
The Windsors regularly attended much more